I think the starting point from which I want to talk about American foreign policy today is to read to you a sentence or two from a book which is about to come out, a narrative history of some events. The vice president argued that obtaining congressional authorization to act was impossible, since opposition was overwhelming, and even if that weren't the case, the administration had all the authority it needed. That's a sentence from which describes Vice President Al Gore speaking about the possibility of American military intervention in Haiti. And one can or could find many similar statements of presidential authority in the years leading up to the distinctive approach of the current administration. The book is, which I recommend, is called America Between the Wars by Derek Chollet and James Goldgeier. It'll be out in a couple of weeks. And Between the Wars means from America from 11-9, the fall of the Berlin Wall, until 9-11. The question raised today is continuity or rupture. And by, I'm assuming that when we talk about the possibility of rupture, we mean 2001 and the switch from previous administrations to the current one. And indeed, in my own book, In Rise of the Balkans, I present the current foreign policy team as a group of people. Can you hear okay?
The mic just left us.
Okay. Let's try this, and if not, I'll...
I know, it was fine. Technology. This one, the technology is so old, we just gave up on it.
How's this now?
No.
Okay. Got it now? Okay, good. In my own book, Rise of the Balkans, I portray the current administration as a group of people who had their own long background, roots, continuities. I am certainly not of the school that believes that Dick Cheney suddenly changed his views in this administration, or that his views were influenced by some current kind of heart problem. I think that his views have deep roots, and I tried to describe in the book how he had been and was a deeply conservative person, even in administrations going back to the 70s, when he was not one of the leading architects of American foreign policy. Similarly for Paul Wolfowitz, one of the leading thinkers for the current administration, there's a continuity on some of his views going way back. I try to describe in the late 70s his views on Iraq, which arose when he was asked by the Defense Department to look at the possibility of protecting the oil fields of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. At the time, it was from possible Soviet invasion, but he became preoccupied with Iraq. He was working then with Dennis Ross in the Pentagon. Rumsfeld had been involved in many of the battles of American foreign policy of the Cold War, and so on. So for them, there's no idea of rupture. I would say the proponents in the current milieu of the idea of rupture come from two very unlikely sources. One is the Bush administration itself, which has argued repeatedly since September 11th that the events of 9/11 created an entirely different context for American foreign policy. In the words of then the Deputy Secretary of State, Richard Armitage, on September 12th, 2001, history starts today. Armitage himself came to leave the administration and to dissent from it. But that was really the spirit with which this administration took on American foreign policy starting after September 11th, that it had so dramatically changed everything that there was what amounted to a rupture. The other proponents of rupture, the idea of rupture, I think, are some liberal Democrats who argue that really what happened in this administration is that a group of people captured American foreign policy coming from nowhere and really represented something dramatically, profoundly different from the past. And my own point of view is that this administration took American foreign policy took the principles and ideas that had gradually been developing in American foreign policy since really 1989, and took them several quanta further than they had been before, that they were different. They have been different in some ways, but that in no way was this a rupture. And let me step back and really give the perspective of a reporter. In some ways, I am limited by the fact that I've tried to watch American foreign policy over a long period of time, and over that period of time, many people change their views and the principles they espouse in response to various situations and in response to their own development. I used the pre-2001 Al Gore as one example. One could certainly do that with the Clintons, but it's certainly not just them. I mean, one of the most interesting and really perceptive comments that I ever got in writing about a book came from Brent Scowcroft, who was, of course, George Bush Sr.'s national security advisor, who said, you know, I've been over the years perceived as written as one of America's leading hawks, and I've been perceived as one of America's leading doves, and my views have changed rarely over the years. In the Democratic Party, Zbigniew Brzezinski right now is a forceful, very trenchant opponent of American policy in Iraq. If you were to go back 10 years and look at the build-up or lead-up to American military action in Kosovo, you would find petitions arguing for forceful American military action that were signed by Richard Perle, Elliot Abrams, Gene Kirkpatrick, and Brzezinski. So you get different, at different times, people propose different things. One more, Colin Powell, if you go way back to 1988 and 1989, there was a debate, an internal debate, in the Pentagon and the White House about military action in Panama. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, William Crow, was adamantly opposed to American military action. The new George H.W. Bush administration appointed a new chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Colin Powell, who was much more willing to countenance American military action in Panama. And the administration went ahead. So, again, over the years, people's views evolve. So I try not to look at American foreign policy as, you know, a certain number of people who are, you know, all good over time, all bad over time. And let's look at the history now, because to me, what we're seeing arises out of American role after the end of the Cold War. And that Panama invasion is a very good place to start, because it took place within weeks. This is late. It's in December of 1989. It took place within weeks after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I would submit to you, and with by far the largest American military action since Vietnam, 20,000 troops. And it was, I think, in conceptual terms, the closest single action to Iraq in 2003 that we have. It was the use of American military force to overthrow a dictator. And the obvious, what was different, well, I'm sure this already occurred to you in the last few seconds, it was Latin America. And if you make a Latin American exception to American foreign policy, then maybe it was different. But otherwise, really boiled down to its essentials, it was not that different from Iraq. Up until then, through the Cold War, America, you get a much more restrained, much more careful use of force. And I want to sort of look at and deconstruct American or Washington, really, terminology about foreign policy in the 90s. In the 90s, you begin to get the use of a shorthand word. I'm not sure that it made it out into the country. It's one of these little sort of beltway words, to whack, W-H-A-C-K. As, do you think we're going to whack him? Or should we whack him, or are we going to whack him? And that was the terminology that was increasingly applied to American, to whether it was Noriega, Milosevic, or repeatedly Saddam Hussein. And it was a very revealing word, because it suggested a very short, quick, parental application of force. You know, this was not should we go to war with, it was not should we wage battle, should we overwhelm, it was really a parental word. Well, at the same time, in the early 90s, you begin to get the development of American strategic doctrine. After 89, there is a short, very short debate in Washington over a peace dividend. Should the United States dramatically cut its military budget? In short, the result is not a dramatic cutback, certainly not what the Democratic Congress was looking for. The proponents, the leading advocates of preserving the military budget beyond the George H.W. Bush administration itself were the Defense Secretary, Dick Cheney, his Undersecretary, Paul Wolfowitz, and Colin Powell together in favor of preserving the defense budget. And in the final years of the Bush senior administration, you get the development of the strategic doctrine, which really holds and is really implemented in this administration. It was called the Defense Planning Guidance of 1992. And it was reported at the time as the United States will act to preclude the emergence of any rival power in strategic regions, Europe, Asia, the Middle East. It was first reported as Japan, as the United States will block the emergence of Japan in Asia. This was the thinking and the fear at the time, or Germany in Europe. You can see with 15 years of hindsight or more how exaggerated the fears were. It was refined. There were objections when there was a leak. Why would the United States be working to hold down its allies, Germany and Japan? It was rewritten was first written by the current ambassador to the United Nations, Zal Khalilzad, and was then rewritten by in the Pentagon by Scooter Libby, then an assistant to Paul Wolfowitz, with much more guarded language, but it went like this, that the United States would preserve its strategic depth around the world. It was a very funny, vague concept. But what it meant was there was no particular rival. The United States would seek to maintain such military power that no country today or in the future could ever try to challenge it, because any country, if the United States military power was so large that any country which sought to challenge it would bankrupt itself. In other words, it would take 40 years and then you couldn't do it. And secondly, that the United States would act to, it was called, shape the security environment. And that was a very nice, bland phrase, which really meant to be active overseas in places like the Middle East to make sure that things went according to American interests. And what's interesting is that although this is sometimes looked on as this really represented the Pentagon of Dick Cheney in the early 90s, but this doctrine was never really replaced and hardly challenged by the Clinton administration. The Clinton administration in 93 to 2000 did not come up with a substitute doctrine. It kind of took this doctrine and left it there without entirely challenging it, and came up with its own terminology for America's role in the world. The most famous phrase was that the United States was the indispensable nation. That phrase is usually attributed to Madeleine Albright, but was in fact a phrase that first came from Bill Clinton. It was written for him by Sidney Blumenthal in the 1996 campaign. And the Clinton version of American role in the world, one could see in a speech to the United Nations, 1994. When our national security interests are threatened, we will act with others when we can, but alone if we must. We will use diplomacy when we can, but force if we must. And the Clinton administration started out with a reliance on the idea of collective security, but really it didn't last long. It really began to go by the wayside after, from its point of view, the debacle in Somalia. It was only a year later that Clinton is talking to the United Nations about, you know, acting on our own and with force when we must. And this leads in the late 90s to military action in Kosovo, which is without UN approval. It would not have gotten UN approval. And in Iraq, where the administration used force three times in 6 years, what it did not do was send in ground troops. This was the sardonic description of Clinton administration policy was diplomacy by cruise missile. That would have been the joke of the late 1990s. So it was air power, but not ground troops. And I would remind everyone that that in the late 90s, the Europeans were complaining about American unilateral power, not to the extent that one heard in 2002 and 3, but they were certainly not pleased with the way things were going. That's the era where you got the idea of American hyperpower. So let me trace through, I think, the four or five different principles which this administration has exhibited, and look at what parts of them are new and what parts are not. What is different about this administration, with Iraq being the prime example, is it unilateralism? And I would say really no, that this administration took unilateralism to the a degree we had not seen it before, but that really there had been examples of American unilateralism right through since the end of the Cold War. And, you know, one can go before that, too. Promotion of democracy from this administration, I mean, that's the easiest example in which to say that there's certainly no rupture. If you, I would recommend that you go back and take a look at the Clinton administration's national security strategy of 1996, in which the words democracy or democratic were used more than 130 times. Use of force. I would have to say, in general, no, that the United States had been willing to use force and on its own in the 90s. War without presidential approval, military action without presidential approval, certainly no. The quote that I gave you of Al Gore and I'm sorry, thank you, without congressional approval, that is assertion of presidential authority. It's not just Haiti, but certainly Kosovo, where again the documents show that the Clinton administration thought specifically about going to Congress and decided no, that it was too risky, and that it might not get it. Well, the doctrine of preemption. In theory, the United States had always reserved for itself the right to carry out a preemptive strike. I would say that the Bush administration took this far beyond anybody's imagined application in this administration, both by using it for preventive war and really in Iraq in ways that stretched beyond all meaning the idea of preemption. That is, what was different about Iraq was the use of force really to intimidate an entire region. That is, you had a subtle policy debate in Washington. In what was the relationship between Iraq and the rest of the Middle East, and the dispute between Israel and the Palestinians? And you had one side pointing to the Gulf War of 1991 and saying, "Look, at the end of that of the previous Gulf War, Arafat was intimidated. The way to make peace between Israel and Palestinians is through Iraq." And you had the other side of this debate saying, we really can't go take military action against Iraq till we deal with Israel and the Palestinians first. And the first side of that debate won with results that were highly unsuccessful. And that comes to the last difference, which is that this administration executed an entirely failed military strategy. That is, it's hard to find in anything of the previous two administrations anything even minutely close to the failure of the Iraq policy. So on that, there's absolutely no comparison. One of the questions raised on the rupture debate is, well, so what would the Gore administration have done? And it seems intuitively obvious to everyone that the Gore administration would have been different. I would, first of all, remind people that in 2001, this would have been the Gore-Lieberman administration, by the way. And I would say that on questions of principle, would the Gore administration have been willing to act unilaterally? Yes. Would it have been willing to use force? Certainly, that was Al Gore's record as something of a hawk in the 80s and as a particularly strong proponent of force in the Bosnia-Kosovo examples of the 90s. It would have been willing to engage in preemptive action. It would, however, not have been, it would not have invaded Iraq in the way at the time. And really, without provocation in the way that the current administration did. So I'm going to end it there. I would raise the question, will there be a rupture in American foreign policy in 2009? And I think on the Republican side, certainly not, that John McCain, who was the, who enjoys ties to several different wings of the Republican Party, but certainly including the neoconservatives, would not represent a rupture of American foreign policy in next year. That it would be, I would hope for a rupture in American foreign policy from a, let's presume now, an Obama administration. And I'd like to think so. I keep throwing out the idea that in Washington that there should be some kind of dramatic break right after January 20th next year, in which the United States signs on to some international treaties, such as the International Criminal Court, to demonstrate that there is a rupture. I'm not finding all kinds of takers on that, and so I'm skeptical about. I think that, you know, I think on some levels there will be a continuity after 2009 as well.
Thank you. Our second speaker is John Mueller. John is the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security.